This is Saturday, the 11th of April, 1986. Interview with Sir Dennis Wright at his home in Buckinghamshire, England. And Sir Dennis, shall we go right to the beginning of your involvement with Iran? You went to the diplomatic service and followed your career naturally, and then at some point you got involved with Persia. I believe it was at the time of the Mossadegh.
Well, it was after Mossadegh fell, in August 1953, and I was head of the economic department of the Foreign Office and was meant to be responsible, among other things, for oil. There was only one man dealing with oil in the Foreign Office. He was under my supervision. His name was Peter Ramsbottom, who later took over from me as ambassador in Iran. And I was asked whether I would go out and reopen diplomatic relations after the resumption, after the fall of Mossadegh, because he had turned us all out in October 1952.
In what capacity at the time?
A chargé d'affaires.
So you went there as chargé d'affaires, and what happened? Tell us all about it.
Well, I was met at the airport by the Swiss minister, Mr. Alfred Escher, who was in charge of British interests at the time and had been since the break in diplomatic relations. And as we drove into the embassy in the Avenue Ferdowsi, he said that he had arranged for me to meet two emissaries of the Shah the following evening. I didn't like the idea because I was absolutely brand new to Iran, and I asked him who they were. He said one was an Iranian whose name, he said, I think he may have told me, I'm not certain, was Bahram Shahrukh. And the other one was a Swiss subject named Ernst Baron, who he said was very close to the Shah. Well, I didn't like this idea at all of meeting someone before I had even presented my credentials as chargé d'affaires to Mr. Entezam, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, but the Swiss had let me in for this. And so next night I went and had dinner with the Swiss minister and his English wife up in the Gullhack compound of the British Embassy, which the Swiss were living in. And I met these two gentlemen. I knew nothing about them. On my staff, when I'd gone out to Tehran, I had only one member who had ever been in Iran before. He'd been the second secretary in the commercial department and wasn't familiar with personalities and so on. The reason we only had that one person was about 10 days before I was due to go out to Iran, just before Christmas 1953, the Iranian government told us that they, via the Swiss, that they did not wish any member of the British team I was to lead out there to have served in Iran before. This was a decision by Mossadegh, and there was a feeling that they must stick by this. Anyway, Anthony Eden decided that at least one member of the staff should know something about Iran, so I took with me someone called John Fernley, the second secretary in the commercial department, and before the break in diplomatic relations. And I say, I met these two gentlemen at dinner, and they after dinner, the Swiss minister and his wife withdrew and left me alone with them. But to my great surprise, they started criticizing the spokesman, was chiefly Bahram Shahrukh, who started criticizing the Prime Minister, General Zahedi. They asked me whether the British government would have any objection if the Shah dismissed the Minister of Court, Mr. Hussein Allah, and they wanted an assurance there would be no interference in internal affairs. And they also said the Shah wished to know how I proposed settling the oil problem. Well, I said that as far as General Zahedi was concerned, only a few days previously in the House of Commons, Mr. Eden had praised, or Sir Anthony Eden, I think he was, had praised General Zahedi for his courage in resuming diplomatic relations, and it seemed to be rather out of place to criticize him now. As regards dismissing Mr. Hussein Allah, I said this wasn't my business at all. What the Shah did with his ministers was his business, not mine. As regards interference in internal affairs, I said that I give an absolutely solemn assurance that there'd be no interference in the order. As regards an oil settlement, I said I have no settlement with me. I've come out to explore the possibilities of a settlement, but I cannot do more than that. Then it will be for the oil companies. Well, in due course they went off, and that was on the 22nd of December 1953. 2 days later, the next day I called on the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Intizam, presented my credentials, as I wasn't an ambassador, so I didn't go and see the Shah, I was dealing with the Foreign Minister. And I just mentioned to him, as a precaution, that I had seen these two emissaries of the Shah, because I thought it would be, might get to his ears by other way, and it would do me damage. So I just told him, en passant. Well, that was the 22nd of December. The 23rd of December I saw Intizam, and 2 days later was our great festival, Christmas Day, and I was having a party for the 14 members of my staff, plus one or two British subjects who had come out to Iran, who had been in Iran, hadn't been expelled by Mossadegh, on drink which we had borrowed from the American embassy, because our embassy was empty. And in the middle of this, there was a telephone call from the Swiss embassy, or legation it then was, to say that the two gentlemen I had seen wished to see me again, urgently. So, according to... Well, they came back and repeated more or less what they had said to me the first time. In particular, they wanted to find out what about I could do about settling the oil problem. They wished to report to the Shah, etc., etc. And I made it clear that I had no solution in my pocket, but I said two things were absolutely essential, that there should be fair compensation for the Anglo-Iranian oil company, and secondly, that any solution must be such that Iran did not do better out of oil than the other Middle Eastern oil-producing countries. In other words, should not be rewarded for nationalizing oil. They also told me that the Shah did not want an ambassador appointed because the British, the Iranian public, he said, had got used to Mr. Wright. Well, that's nonsense, I'd only been there 48 hours, but they... said to them that I was not, had no oil solution, and that I could not negotiate anything behind the back of the foreign minister. If they want, I was very happy to go and see the Shah and explain to him, but I was not prepared to work behind the back of the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And that as regards an ambassador, I said, I already have the name of an ambassador whose agrément I am to ask for as soon as I judge the situation right. I said, I'm only here to charge you that fellow. Well, they went off again, and I continued with my drinks party. We had a Christmas lunch, and then in the afternoon, I was feeling a bit sleepy. Perhaps I'd had too much to drink, I don't know. Anyway, the telephone went again, and the Swiss people said they wished to see me again. Monsieur Perron and the Baron Sharok. They came back, I did about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and Sharok, who did all the speaking, talked good English, had a piece of paper, 2 pages, which he handed to me, and he said, we have consulted the Shah after the morning's talk, and these are his views, and I've no doubt they were his views, again saying that whereas they had no objection, or the Shah had no objection to my discussing oil with Mr. Intizam on minor details, on all matters of principle, I was to deal with him direct through Perron and Sharok. And I said, I'm very sorry, I would go and explain this to the Shah, and I repeated what I'd said in my earlier talks. Well, I was very worried about this, because, I mean, there was a confrontation with the Shah as soon as I arrived in Tehran. So I slept on it. It's sometimes a good thing not to take too much quick action. So I slept on it and discussed it with the other members of my staff. And next morning, Boxing Day, I sent a telegram to London giving the full text of the piece of paper that I'd been given, and saying that I thought I should tell Mr. Intizam, the Foreign Minister, in whom I had complete confidence. I'd only met him once, but he struck me as an absolutely honest, straight man.
That was Nasrullah, wasn't
no,
it?
No, no, Abdullah.
This was Abdullah.
Abdullah.
Oh, yes.
Abdullah. And I said that I must, would like to tell him. Well, this was a big decision. It had to be taken by Mr. Eden or Sir Anthony Eden personally. And so I got a telegram back a day later saying I was authorized to tell the foreign minister what the Shah was up to. So next time I saw Prince Azam, I think on the 27th of December, I told him. I gave him a complete account of what had happened and what I'd said. And I gave him assurance. I said, so long as I'm in charge here, I shall do nothing behind your back. You will. Well, the only person I told was the American ambassador, who was a very good ally of ours on this, Laurie Henderson, who had been very helpful in getting diplomatic relations resumed. And I told him all this. And sat back. Well, a few days later, I was at a party where a French lady married to an Iranian, Fernand Fouroughi, who her husband was private secretary to Princess Shams and was very close to the Shah at that time, attacked me at a party and said, how dare you behave so badly towards the Shah? And I said, what do you know about this? You don't know my version of the story. And her husband was in bed with a cold or influenza, and I said, well, my husband should hear why all this. So I went up and saw Masoud Fouroughi at his house in El Ahiyeh, where he was in bed, and explained why I was not prepared to deal with Perron and Shah Rukh behind the back of the foreign minister. Well, a few days later, the Belgian ambassador came to see me. He'd heard the story. I was having a first-class row with the Shah, etc. I said, I'm not having a first class row. I haven't seen him, haven't asked to see him. I'm not a... Then, a few days after that, the American ambassador telephoned me and said, come round and have a drink. I went round and he said, I've just seen the Shah. He's back from the Caspian. And he said, he's actually hopping mad with you and with me too, because he thought the American had put me up to this. Of course, the American hadn't. He'd had, I'd done nothing. I'd not told him until it was all over. And he said, don't worry, it won't do you any harm. Well, anyway, I didn't see the Shah for some time until the anniversary of his wedding anniversary to Queen Soraya, which was early in February, should you think, about the 10th, I've forgotten the date. And I was going to, I was invited because it was all the diplomatic corps were invited. And the new Iranian ambassador to London, by this time Roger Stevens was nominated for Tehran, and Ali Suheili was nominated to go back to London, where he'd already been ambassador. And he, of course, knew all about this. All Tehran knew about this row I was having. He said to me at this party, he said, stick by me, I'm going to make the Shah talk to you. Well, there was a very glittering party in the Marble Palace, and glass mirrors all over the place and so on. And the Shah and Queen Soraya came down a long line of diplomats and ministers and generals, and the Shah got to me. I was the bottom of the line, the junior diplomat. He took me by the hand, he didn't say a word, I just passed on. And Queen Soraya did the same, but then after the line broke up, we went to eat, Soraya talked to me for a bit. And then Zuhaili beckoned to me and went over to see the Shah by the dinner table, which was a buffet, and he got into quite a heated argument with the Shah. Later he told me this was because the Shah said he wouldn't talk to me. And Zuhaili said, why should I talk to this man? There's a new ambassador arriving next week. This is Roger Stevens and wife. But Zuhaili is a tough character. He stuck to his guns, and after about 10 minutes, I was summoned up to see the Shah, talked to him. And we had a very friendly talk. He didn't refer to this incident at all. And that was my first contact.
What did you talk about then?
Well, we talked about his plans for the future. He said he was plans to modernize his country, and said, some people say I'm a socialist. I don't think we talked about oil at all, but I've forgotten. But anyway, he did all the talking until Queen Soraya got impatient and wanted to get started with the dancing and things, and pulled pulled him away, and that was that. So after that, of course, an ambassador came, and I didn't have many dealings with the Shah, except indirectly. But he didn't seem to bear me any ill will. And when he went to New York in America, after the settlement of the oil at the end of 1954, he told one British diplomat, an old friend of his, Lawford, who had been in Tehran, he said very nice things about Roger Stevens and about me, so he had no feelings. So usually the Shah, as you know, very vindictive and never forgives anybody, but in this case he apparently bore me no ill will. And indeed, when I left Tehran in October 1955, I was called back to London to be Under Secretary in the Foreign Office. I was in charge again because Roger Stevens was away on leave. He gave a dinner for my wife and myself at the palace up in the Sam Shimran Hills.
Saadabad
Palace, where he made a little speech thanking me for having contributed to Anglo-Iranian friendship, etc., etc. There were only about, I think, 14 or 15 people there. But it was a very touching occasion because, of my knowledge, he's never given a farewell dinner to any chargé d'affaires or counsellor, and not even to an ambassador, because when I was later 8 years ambassador and was on very good terms with the Shah and was doyen of the diplomatic corps, he never would dream of giving a farewell dinner to me. But then I was just a junior member of staff. He gave this farewell dinner to my wife and myself. So that's it.
So that was your first trip to Iran. Now, there is one thing that I would like to ask, simply because I'm sure that a lot of people will ask in future when they read about the whole history of that era, is this, about the British policy towards Iran. I mean, why were the British so acharné, so adamant against Mossadegh, where later on they accepted every nationalization, and indeed they fostered them in their various zones of influence whereby they wanted to pull out. If they hadn't done that, of course all the subsequent troubles would have been avoided, and probably we would now, by now, have a constitutional monarchy and a much more advanced case. I mean, why was it?
Well, I wouldn't agree at all with you on that, because I think you have idealized Mossadegh. The reason why we were against Mossadegh was quite simply that it seemed impossible to make an agreement with him.
You mean you were not against the principle of nationalization?
No, we accepted that. We said there must be fair compensation, and he would never accept that, you see. We never got it, but the decision, I mean, as you know, ultimately the British and then the Americans carried it out, but the coup to get rid of Mossadegh was decided on when they'd come to the conclusion that it was totally impossible to make an agreement with Mossadegh. He has proved very, very slippery, and I haven't got all the details, but if you read all the accounts that are available in the public record of this, move after move by the World Bank, by the Americans, the only person who thinks he got near an agreement, I think, is George McGee at one stage, the American, and he was Under Secretary in the State Department. But it was too late when he came along with us. Just at any rate, they never managed to pin Mossadegh down to doing what you call a fair compensation, because for the British it was absolutely vital that there should be some fair settlement to have compensation, because after all we have major interests all over the world at that time, and still have, but including then of course the Suez Canal, and to let Mossadegh get away without any compensation would have encouraged Nasser, would have, as in fact it did encourage him in the end, in any case, and all sorts of other enterprises. So we were determined to have fair compensation. and a proper settlement, and that was the reason. But to take up your other point, if anybody really believes that Mussolini would have led to a nice constitutional government, I think they're just living in cuckoo land, because you've only got to look at the chaotic state Iran was in under Mossadegh, without any British interference at that time. I mean, it was, Mossadegh was unlikely, I think, to have ever made a success any more than previous politicians did. I mean, he wasn't strong enough. He was already at loggerheads with the Shah. He hadn't got the army behind him. I don't think there was a ghost of a chance of Mossadegh being a successful prime minister. He was a national hero, yes, because he kicked the British out, but that's quite a different thing. But as a successful prime minister and avoiding all the troubles, it's a very easy way for the Iranians to excuse what is really their own many mistakes.
Yes, quite. But what? No, I only ask the question because I'm sure that other people will.
Yeah.
And this is the impression, you see.
The real thing is to study the papers in the Public Record Office, which quite a lot of them, in fact. No, I haven't got the book here. Roger Lewis, a professor of history at the University of Texas, has written a book called The British Empire in the Middle East. And the first volume came out year before last, and there's a new volume coming out, of which there'll be a lot about the oil crisis. I mean, and that will give, you know, the whole picture, I think, because it's a very dispassionate American view of the thing.
But it's very interesting what you say, that Mossadegh wouldn't have been any more successful than the previous people had been. Why do you suppose that is? Because of the difference between the Shah and...
Well, firstly, he, given the constitution in America, in Iran, the Shah was a key figure, and he was not a supporter of Mossadegh. He had very briefly at one period supported him, but on the whole he was anti-Mossadegh. He wouldn't have backed him for long. And the economic condition of the country was such, because of the embargo on oil and all that sort of thing, that Mossadegh greatly misjudged the effect of nationalization too. See, he seemed to think that you'd have no difficulty in extracting oil and selling it. Well, of course, all the oil companies rallied together with Anglo-Iranian, because although in many people in this country, in England, are inclined to say, well, the Americans got us out of Iran, it's untrue. They didn't like to see this happen, because if it had happened in Iran, the Mossadegh had got away with nationalizing it. After all, it was a British enterprise in which we had invested millions of pounds, and maybe we made a lot of money out of it too, but we did invest enormous sums. But for the British, it would not have been an oil industry at that time. And the American oil companies saw that if Mossadegh got away with just, you might say, stealing British investment, this would happen in Saudi Arabia, it would happen all around the world, you see.
But as a result, you got 50 years of free oil. Wouldn't that be enough?
With what?
50 years of free oil wasn't enough.
But that wasn't...
That's what Mossadegh's argument was. I mean, I'm being just the devil's advocate because it's interesting. Yeah. His argument was, all right, you invested some money, you extracted the oil, but as a result you got 40 years of oil free, or 30 years or whatever it is.
Well, it
that's your compensation.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't free at all. I mean, how many million pounds went into the refinery, building the refinery? How much went into drilling oil? 8 years, they got the concession, was 1903, didn't find oil till 1908. All that time they were drilling, drilling. What do you think that costs? What do you think it costs to have tankers to market them? You know, I mean, it was an enormous investment in the country. All right, they made a lot of money in the end, but it's risk capital. I mean, if you're going to put money, and it isn't just in oil, but in something risky, you've got to get a good return on it. I mean, that's the way capitalism works.
Yes, well, let us move on from there. So you came back to London, and then what happened? Did your involvement with Persia end at that point, or did you carry on with oil consortium?
No, I was undersecretary in charge of economic affairs, and I, among other things, had to do with the Baghdad Pact. I was the economic there, and of course I got involved again with Persia there, because I used to go to the Baghdad PAC meetings, and Jamshid Musagar would be leading the Iranian delegation. And one famous occasion, notable occasion, when I'd been to Karachi in January 1959, and Dr. Iqbal was there. He was Prime Minister. Hassan Afta was ambassador to Pakistan and to Ankara, and they both got hold of me. They knew me well from my first days, and hinted that something very funny was happening in Tehran. They didn't say what, I couldn't quite make out, but they seemed to think the British embassy had got involved and were encouraging the Shah to do a deal with the Russians. I was rather perplexed. But then I was going to take a week's holiday in Iran on my way back from Karachi. At dinner, my first night in Tehran, I met Hussein Allah, Minister of Court, and he urged me to see the Shah. He said I hadn't got the right clothes, I hadn't come to see the Shah, I was on holiday.
You said that what year was that?
That was in January 1959.
And that was Geoffrey Harrison, who was British ambassador.
And we knew from top secret sources that a Russian delegation had arrived in Tehran the same day as I did. And we, putting two and two together, assumed that Allah wanted me to see the Shah because of this, because the Russians, we had learned from secret sources, so secret we couldn't let on, we knew, that to negotiate a non-aggression pact with the Iranian government. And this was why Dr. Iqbal and Hussein Hassan Akhtar in Karachi were so worried, because they didn't like the idea. Anyway, the result was that I said to Allah, I will go and sign the Shah's book just to show I'm here, but I don't want to see him particularly. I went down the next day to the court, to the palace, the Marble Palace, signed the book, and was met by Mohsen Karakoglu, who was the Grand Master of Ceremonies, and he said, "Mr. Allah wants to talk to you on the telephone." Well, Allah, who always before addressed me as Mr. Wright, this time on the telephone from his office in the court, said, "My dear Dennis, I have arranged you to see the Shah, I don't know if it's tomorrow or the next day or something, and I beg you to speak to him very frankly." Well, in other words, he was telling me to try and stop him signing a deal with the Russians. At lunch that same day, I wasn't at the lunch, but Allah, not knowing that we knew the Shah was doing this, told Geoffrey Harrison that the Shah was doing a secret deal with the Russians. A very brave thing for Allah to do, but he felt so passionately it'd be wrong to be tied up with the Russians that he told Geoffrey Harrison. Well, Harrison telegraphed to London and said I was seeing the Shah next day or the day after, I've forgotten which, and asked for instructions. So I got a brief to try and persuade the Shah not to sign with the Russians. So I went into bat with the Shah, and I had an audience which was, instead of lasting just half an hour, lasted an hour and a half. We had a great battle when I told him that if he signed up with the Russians, he would sooner or later lose his throne, as inevitably would happen. Well, because it would mean pulling out of the Baghdad Pact. I said the Russians don't like monarchies, and you can't believe that the Russians are not going to try and upset your regime. The interview went on for an hour and a half. One stage of Shah's complaint was that as a member of CENTO, he wasn't being given as many aeroplanes and as many guns as the Turks were getting, who were members, and also he complained that the Afghans were doing better, although they weren't even members of CENTO. And he went on to complain, I think it was called Baghdad Pact, and it wasn't called CENTO. At one stage he said, "You treat me like a kept woman, not like a married partner." But I said, "Well, Your Majesty, kept women earn fur coats if they behave themselves," or something. I got a smile out of him then. Anyway, at the end of it all, I left him feeling rather despondent that I hadn't influenced him. But we know later, from when he came to London in May on a state visit, he told the then British Prime Minister Macmillan and our Foreign Minister, Uncle Selwyn Laird, that it was my intervention which had stopped him. Other people intervened. Eisenhower sent a telegram. Duncan Sands came. He was on his way back from Karachi, Pakistan. Turkish Prime Minister stopped off in Tehran. They all put pressure on him, but he did tell Macmillan it was my intervention. But typical of the Shah, he put all the blame for this episode on Sayyid Zia Tabatabai, because he said Sayyid Zia was known as a British agent, and he had gone to the Shah and had told him that the British wanted him to do this deal with the Russians. Well, of course, it was a complete lie. First of all, Sayyid Zia was not a British agent. He was a friend of ours, but we just used to go and spend a day in the country with him. He was never a British agent, and I used to go and see him occasionally, just as other members of the embassy, but at intervals of 1 month or 6 months' time. But he was, this was a Sergio was a friend. I used to go out to his farm out in the hills occasionally, but never, to my knowledge, did we ever use him as a secret agent. Anyway, Mr. Shah maintained that he was known to be a spokesman of the British Embassy. I mean, the Shah was very gullible, like a great many Iranians, and believed all sorts of people were spokesmen of the British Embassy when they're not. And the last thing Sergio was. So that was that.
And so after the week holiday you came back, and
yeah,
your involvement with Persia continued?
Yes, as a, on the economic side, so it wasn't very great.
Well, you mean just the oil and then...
Well, oil to some extent, but you see the oil agreement had been reached in 1954.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd come back in 55, and after that there were no serious problems over oil. I mean, there were disputes maybe between the oil companies, but not involving the Foreign Office at all.
So, what other economic...
I was dealing with the free trade area, with a common market, with control of arms, control of shipments to the Soviet Union. I was dealing with the whole world, I mean, on economic affairs, on Argentine meat, I mean, everything I was dealing with.
And then you were appointed ambassador. When was that?
April 1973. I went out as ambassador.
73? April 1963. You were appointed an ambassador.
Yeah.
And you went out there and you stayed about 7 years.
8 years.
Eight years. Amazing. So tell us about that, because obviously it's a fantastic...
Well, it would take far too long to tell you about it. I've recorded this for Harvard, and it will be released in the year 2000, but all I would say is that it was a very agreeable time for me. I mean, the Shah then seemed to be, he'd got over the referendum, he'd got a backing from his people in January or February 1963, he'd been married for the third time to Paradipa, he'd got a son and heir, and so although when I first arrived in April 63, I had certain doubts about the Shah arising from these earlier experiences, and I said so. I said in my first dispatch to the Foreign Office, so long as the Shah is here, no good will come to this country, despite them. And I changed my mind in the course of the next 2 or 3 years, because it seemed to me he had taken the grip of himself, he was behaving more rationally, become stronger, and particularly after the Muharram riots of 1963, June 63, when I think the Shah did the right thing. I mean, he clamped down on the mullahs, and there were a good many people killed, but I was there, and I don't believe for 1 minute the accounts one reads by opposition to the Shah, that 5,000 people were killed, 15,000. At the time, I asked Mr. Alam, who was then Prime Minister, how many people had been killed, and he told me, I think the number was 94. And he said that was based on the people who had been on burials, the people who had asked for compensation for pensions and things. And years later, when he was no longer Prime Minister, but when I was still ambassador, I asked him again, were you telling me the truth? He said, yes, as far as I know, about 94. Well, years later, when I was sent by Mrs. Thatcher, I retired to see the Shah at Nassau to tell him he wasn't coming to England. I asked him then how many people were killed at the Muharram riots. And he said 110, straight off. So I said to him, well, that's very interesting, because Mr. Alam told me 94, and there's not much difference between the two. And I said, I've always maintained I was there, I heard the shooting, I was moving up to Gulhek every day. And he repeated, he said, no, 110. Well, I just quote these figures, because I believe that that was the sort of figure, and it wasn't a great slaughter. And therefore, I always felt that that Muharram riot and the Shah getting tough with the, it was Alam rather than the Shah, I think, but nevertheless, it was the Shah's policy, was a turning point in the development of Iran for the next, what, 8 years to 1971, I think, when Iran made remarkable progress economically, internationally. The Shah became a worldwide figure, and I changed my views from my earlier criticism of him to think that here was a man who had got a grip of himself, who was happily married. As we know, he wasn't quite so happily married, but still, I mean,
was he not?
Well, he got married to another girl and all this on it. And
Were those not just rumors?
No, I had his aunt tell me when he came here one day, he said it was quite definite, a lady and a daughter of some governor in Kurdistan, and Entezam was quite firm on this. But I don't know, I won't speculate about that, but nevertheless.
Yeah, but that, as the French say, c'est un ambiche pas de sentiment. That doesn't stop. I mean, a lot of people have mistresses on the side. It doesn't mean that they are not happily married.
Yes, well, because Alam used to say to me that from about 1968, that he could no longer influence the Shah, make any impression on him, and he said he was very worried for the Empress, but she was also running foul of the Shah for championing this or that cause. But I don't know, it's a speculation, so it's not. I believed up to the time I left Iran that the Shah had was moving in the right direction. Although my last two or three dispatches before retiring in April 1971, I did foretell that there was trouble ahead for the Shah unless he could satisfy the liberals and the intellectuals and the students. I didn't anticipate trouble from the mullahs. I didn't see it there at all, and I don't think it necessarily existed then. But I also said that I thought the Shah was liable to take impetuous decisions, and there might be he might make some mistakes, but I thought on the whole not. But in fact, of course, we know he did make terrible mistakes.
I was told myself by some Foreign Office friend that the British were so afraid of antagonizing the Shah because of the trade dealings and so forth that they appointed people who didn't speak Persian deliberately.
They didn't what?
Appointed people at the embassy who didn't speak Persian. The instructions to the diplomats were that they shouldn't be in touch with any opposition, intellectual, nationalist, anybody. Isn't that rather short-sighted?
It's short-sighted, but I think there's some truth in that. You see, the trouble is, the Shah was an extremely jealous person, and he had Sabak. The ambassador and his embassy is to be successful, it's got to deal with the ruling few, the top people. I mean, you're accredited to a government. In the case of Iran, the Shah was so jealous of anybody having any dealings with anybody in opposition to him that it would compromise the ambassador if his staff were involved. So we had to be very cautious. And I'll give you an example of this. John Loudon, the chairman of Shell, the Dutch chairman, he was retiring, and he had negotiated with Americans and the British the oil agreement in 1954. He didn't know the Dutch ambassador, and he asked if he could stay with me. And we put him up, and I said, what would you like me to do by way of entertainment? And he said he would like to meet the men he had negotiated the oil agreement with in 1954. They were Ali Amini, who had been prime minister later and then dismissed by the Shah, Fuad Rouhani, who had been the first director general of OPEC, and Abdullah Entezam, who had been minister of foreign affairs. They were the key figures in the oil negotiations. All three of them, by the time Loudon came to Tehran, were in disgrace. They quarreled with the Shah. And I knew if I had them to dinner and the Shah heard about it, I would be in trouble. So I decided I would have them to dinner, but I saw Mr. Alam and said, look, I'm having these people to dinner, and Mr. Loudon was a guest, and please tell the Shah. Well, that was all right. The Shah knew. But my American colleague, Armin Mayer, had met Ali Amini's sister-in-law, I've forgotten her name, but a rather handsome, well-dressed lady. she introduced him to Ali Amini, who after all had been ambassador in Washington. Armin Meir had him, Amini, to dinner with his sister-in-law. The Shah heard of this through Sabak or through somebody. He was furious, and for a good many months Armin Meir was in trouble with the Shah for having had Amini to dinner. That was what one was up against in Iran, and that was why the British, and I think the Americans, decided that it was not good policy to flirt with the opposition in the country.
So how did you collect your intelligence then, to see what was the opposition, how strong it was, what's the...
Well, they thought it was, we didn't collect enough intelligence about it. I think that is one of the troubles. I mean, we knew there was discontent, I mean, in the country. I don't know what happened after 1971. I was out of the picture. And the opposition to the Shah when I was there was relatively small. I mean, the country was behind him. They'd been successful with land reform. I remember Nancy Lambton, who was again the Shah, coming to me one day after she'd done one of her great trips around the country and telling me that she was pleased and surprised to find there was so much support behind the Shah. And I think up until 1970, and probably about 69 or 70, the Shah was riding on a successful wave, and it wasn't there. What happened afterwards, I don't know, I wasn't there. Whether I would have been any wiser than others, I don't know. But I do know in 1977, when I went, 2 years before the revolution, I saw Dr. Ekbal at his office. I was launching my book, The English Amongst the Persians, and I was very busy. I had a whole succession of invitations, and I was signing copies of the book, and I allowed myself 10 minutes with Dr. Ekbal. Dr. Ekbal is, you know, the yes man of the Shah, Baligu man, as they call him. Gu Bali man, I mean, not Baligu, Gu Bali man, isn't it? A yes man of the Shah. I went to see him, and he kept me for 1 hour, and it was one long tirade against the Shah, against the corruption, against the activities of the royal family, against the discontent. Well, that was April 77, and I was still there. Now, I've got that recorded in the diary I've got here. Whether that was, I reported to the ambassador, I don't know whether this was reported back to London or not. But, you know, one wasn't entirely without sources of information at that time.
But not during your tenure, of course.
Well, I had friends, I won't name them, but I had a number of friends who were against the Shah and wished to come and see me. I mean, they were what would be the old liberals of the, you know, the constitutionalists, older generation. They used to come and talk to me, and I was well aware that there was a certain amount of discontent.
And did you let the Foreign Office know about this?
Oh, yes.
And what was their reaction?
Well, they didn't react. I just told them it wasn't a discontent to lead to any serious trouble at that time. I mean, there wasn't any trouble in 1970.
What about the mullahs? Because you see, as you say, the Persians really believe very firmly that the cause at the time of the Constitutional Revolution, the British backed the mullahs who were pro revolution. They managed to keep in touch with them right through, and they influenced the course of events with Khomeini.
One of the great Iranian myths, the British link with the mullahs was a very short one, 1901 to about 1905, up to the, and it certainly had come to an end by the time of the Anglo-Russian agreement in 1907. And it was never resumed, to the best of my knowledge. I've looked through a great many papers in the Foreign Office and so on, and I don't believe there's any, but a very temporary one. And if you want the record of that, you should read the introduction to my latest book. It's in, I'll give the record of where the papers are to be found in the Foreign Office, why we established contact with the mullahs, which was not to undermine the position of the Shah, but to try and restrain him being too pro-Russian.
I would like to ask you a few questions about your relationship with certain personalities there. I gather that you didn't get on very well with Ardeshir Zahedi, and that at one point it became so difficult that you went to the Shah and said, how can I operate as an ambassador if I can't deal with your foreign minister?
Yeah. quite untrue.
Is it?
I didn't get on particularly well with him, but I never went to the Shah and complained about him at all. And I always was well received by Zahedi. We were temperamentally quite different people, and I think he always rather resented that when my first Christmas in Tehran, when he was ambassador in London, he sent a very handsome present of a gold watch with the image of the Shah on it to my wife, and also a couple of rock crystal and silver salt cellars. And we have a strict rule in the Foreign Office about accepting gifts when we're in office. So I wrote a letter to Ardeshir Zahedi and said I was very embarrassed by these handsome presents. If you'd sent me something simple like a book, I would have been very happy to receive it. But under Foreign Office rules, I could not accept such expensive presents and return them. And I think he always resented this action of mine. But apart from that, we got on reasonably well. And when I left the country altogether, I went to say goodbye to him in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And not only did he kiss me on both cheeks, but he went to his safe in his office and produced the same watch which he'd given to my wife and I'd sent back and asked me to accept it. And I accepted it because I was retiring. But I also had a certain amount of problem with him over the Bahrain issue, and he took a very emotional line about it. But the Shah, realizing this, not that he didn't hear it from me, when it came to really negotiating on Bahrain, he instructed me, the Shah, to deal exclusively with Amir Afshar, who was Deputy Foreign Minister. But it's totally untrue that I ever complained about Ardeshir Zahedi or was not on reasonably good terms with him.
So that takes care of Ardeshir Zahedi, who at the time was Foreign Minister. And then you had dealings with Afshar over a number of years, both over Bahrain and when he was ambassador in London and that kind of thing. Maybe tell us about your relationship with him and your impression of his personality and the kind of dealings that he...
Well, he was a very polished diplomat, a man of, I'd say, very false pride in his position, I think. But on Bahrain, he was... skillful. I didn't always agree with him, and I had to appeal to the Shah, as you've heard the broadcast I did the other day with Tony Parsons on the Bahrain thing. There were problems over how we tackle the problem of settling Bahrain, and where I disagreed with him, I went to the Shah, and in a couple of very crucial points, the Shah overruled Afshar, but he was acting as a good Iranian diplomat, and I have no complaint on that score. My only complaint is that when we finally got caught up in the problem of the wording of a letter to be sent to the Secretary General of the United Nations asking him to use his good offices in settling it, the wording used by the Iranians as drafted by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Tehran, I don't know by whom, was so offensive to the British and to the Iranians that it was unacceptable. And this was contrary to what I had originally agreed with Afshar. And I was home on leave, my last leave before retirement, and in the end it was decided the only way to settle this was me to see the Shah, who was at St. Moritz. So I went to see him there, and Afshar, I said it's essential that Afshar be there, because he was still, although then ambassador in London, was still handling these Bahrain, very delicate, very secret Bahrain negotiations. And the Shah gave instructions that I was to work out a formula with Afshar in the next room, which I did, and agreed. I said, I accept this on behalf of the British government. He said, well, I'll take it to the Shah. He went in to see the Shah, who said, when we left him, I'll be here till 7 o'clock. Any problems, come and see me. And after 10 minutes or so, Afshar returned and said, the Shah agrees. So because I was a little bit suspicious and cautious by nature, I said, please read out exactly what has been agreed so there's no misunderstanding. So he went out and had put back almost everything which I had cut out. So I exploded and said this was not what I had agreed. So Afshar said, His Imperial Majesty Shah and Shah, etc., etc., has agreed, you cannot alter it. I said, I don't care damn what the Shah says. This is not what I agreed for the British government, and I don't accept it. That Shah tried to bully me into accepting it, and I refused. I said, all right, I'll go and see the Shah myself. And then he crumbled, and he went back to the Shah, and a few minutes later he was back and said, the Shah agreed. So then, because I didn't trust Afshar one inch after that, I said, you get it typed out and give it to me, and then I will accept it. And so I made him go off and have it typed out, and then I accepted it.
Yeah.
And telephoned to London, and he asked me to have dinner with him, but I refused. I was not going to sit down at the same table with him.
But after that, you sort of were on amicable terms. I mean, after the...
Well, he was ambassador in London. He blacklisted me here. I never was invited to the Iranian embassy because was ambassador. And at the first dinner after I retired of the Iran Society, there were 500 and something people in the Savoy Hotel. Lord Shawcross was chairman. Princess Alexandra was a guest of honor. And the Shah, Afshar made a speech which he attacked the British government about the islands, Abu Musa and the Tums, which had not yet been settled. This was October, I think. And a most unhelpful speech when I knew perfectly well, and Afshar knew, that we were moving towards a settlement on these islands. And I was asked after dinner, I was absolutely furious because there were people like chairman of BP, the head of the Foreign Office, were all there, and I'd been building up Iran as a country we should help, and there were, you know, decent people, and here was Afshar making this monstrous speech. And Shahpurian, who was a press attaché, came up to me and said, what do you think of this speech by Mr. Afshar? I said, it's the most disgusting performance I've heard for a long time, and you can tell him so. Well, 2 days later, Shahpurian telephoned from me, and the Iranian embassy, and I'm sure Afshar was listening in and said, the ambassador has had your message, he wants you to know that he was trying to help the British government. So I said, don't talk such balls to me. I said, this is a very, if I'd been Princess Alexandra, I should have walked out. Well, from then onwards, Afshar, I was on his blacklist. And a few days after that, Dr. Ekbal came down to have lunch with us here. He had been at the dinner, and he asked me what I thought about the speech. I said I was not impressed. It was, and Ekbal said he thought it was a very bad performance, and I'm going back to tell the Shah. And there's no doubt that Afshar got into trouble, not through me, but through Ekbal. But he blamed me, and of course, then onwards I was on his blacklist, so I was never invited to the Iranian embassy.
So you haven't seen him since?
No. He once put out feelers also. Sadiq's son, asked me to have lunch with Afshar about 2 years ago, but I refused.
Now, although I heard your debate on the radio about the Bahrain situation with the other politicians involved, people who are going to listen to these in 20 years' time haven't. So could you sort of tell us about what it was all about over Bahrain and how the negotiations went and what happened eventually?
Well, Bahrain had been in dispute with the British for 150 years or more. The Iranians had, as the BBC made point, quite a good claim historically. It had been part of the Iranian Empire. There was at one period, I think, one of the British representatives made some mission of the Iranian sovereignty over it. But the British, by and large, had been consistent throughout the 19th century that this would belong to the Sheikh of Bahrain, and the Iranians had no claim to it.
And now we're protecting them.
We had a treaty of protection, as we had with all the other Gulf sheikhdoms. Well, when the British government decided, announced publicly they were going to withdraw from the Persian Gulf, I think it was made by 1968, they decided the best way to leave behind a sort of stable position in the Gulf among these sheikhdoms was to try and encourage a federation. And they announced this, and the sheikhs announced it, and we wanted a federation of all the Gulf sheikhs, including Bahrain. And this worried the Iranians, who saw this as a very devious British move to confront them with accepting the surrender of Bahrain, Abu Musa and the Toms. So there was a very violent Iranian reaction. I haven't got the wording, but you they talked about it. There was an official announcement from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs talking about how these territories had been acquired by fraud and deceit by the British government, etc., etc. And so we were in a jam. I went to see the Shah twice, I think in June and again in August 1968, to see whether we couldn't reach some overall agreement, not just about Bahrain, but about Abu Musa, about the median line for oil, about all the issues in dispute. But Shah wouldn't play ball, except he said that if on Bahrain, he said, I don't want to take it over, but I've historically got a claim to it, and therefore if I'm going to give it up, and after all, he said, the pearls have run out, the oil is running out, it's no good to me. I must have some face-saving formula. And he wanted a referendum, or a plebiscite, or the same thing really. And I had to tell him that this, it was impossible, because Bahrain has no voting system, they've got no means of having a referendum, and any attempt to have one would have not been acceptable to the Sheikh. And he wouldn't accept this. So for August, when I had a meeting down at the Caspian with him, right through until November or December, we were on a dead deadlock, the impasse. Senator Massoudi, Abbas Massoudi, who was the editor and publisher of Etalat, used to come and talk to me about Bahrain. He always felt it's something that should be settled, and we had a number of talks. His English was nil. His French wasn't frightfully good, and my Persian was not very good, but we did our talks mostly in Persian and in some French. And I, without any authority from London, but on the strength of a one sentence in a telegram I received from the Foreign Office, said, well, what about trying to do this through the United Nations, settling it that way? But I said, I couldn't, I had no authority for doing this. But he said, well, I'll talk to Shah, I'm seeing him tomorrow night or something. 2 days later, he telephoned me and said, come and see me, have a tea with me. We used to take turns having tea, and I went to see him. And he said, the Shah likes this idea. So I then telegraphed to London and said that this United Nations idea was something the Shah seemed. So then the Foreign Office worked on this. There was a great deal of doubt there whether it was possible. The UN people didn't know it would be possible. Bahrain didn't know. But anyway, in the end, I got instruction just before Christmas that yes, we will try this, but because we don't trust the Iranians don't trust us, the Bahrainese don't trust either of us, we've got to have everything in writing at every stage. And I went to the Shah on Christmas Eve 1968 and said, look, this is a possible way of getting the United Nations to go and sound public opinion in Bahrain. And the Shah, who had been prepared a little bit by Massoudi, said, yes, this is a constructive idea. I like it. But he said, it'll take time, because I've got to educate public opinion. Well, I telegraphed London. I said we'd have to move at every step written. And I also asked him, I said, who shall I deal with? Because I knew that Ardeshir Zahidi, his foreign minister, was not in favor of any settlement on Bahrain. He was very emotional on the thing. I had a big scene in my house one night about it.
Saying what?
Saying I will fight for my country. Bahrain is as much as in part of Iran as Surrey is of England, you know. So I asked the Shah, who shall I deal with? I can't bother you every 5 minutes. So he said, you'll deal with Afshar. And that's how Afshar got involved. Well, the next day, Christmas Day, I was summoned by Afshar. The Shah had seen him between my evening interview and going to India the next morning to tell him to get on with us. So that was a good sign. Then I thought I'd have to wait several months while he prepared public opinion, but not a bit. On the 4th of January at a press conference in New Delhi, he was asked a question about Bahrain, and he said that he would not want to use force, and would be guided by the wishes of the people. And this, I remember reading this in Etalata. I used to get the paper every evening, and I read this in the Persian edition. The Persian wasn't that good, but I understood. I got very excited, and I telephoned my counselor. It was in the evening, to say, look, this is the first breakthrough we've got. And from then onwards, negotiations proceeded. But the Shah acted without telling anybody what he was going to do, and it was a very, like I said, bold, wise, and courageous decision, because as you know, the United Nations got involved, and they sounded public opinion, as came out in the BBC, Winspear, who heard that there was overwhelming support for independence, and the Shah accepted it.
And what about the other islands?
That was quite a separate thing. I retired when they were settled. I left in April, and there was no deal on islands versus Bahrain. I mean, the islands were treated quite separately. But we told the Shah that we will look at this as sympathetically as we can. And I was involved in the early days on the island thing, but Sir William Luce was brought back from the town.
This is tape number 2 with Sir Dennis Wright on the 11th of April 1986 at his home in Buckinghamshire. Carry on, you were saying about the other islands.
Yes, well, on the other island, I was not there when it was finally settled, but when I retired from Tehran, April 1971, I went down the Gulf, chiefly for my own interest, because I'd never been able to go there when I was in Iran. And I did see the sheikhs, the Sharjah and Ras Al Khaimah, the two sheikhs involved, and did my best to persuade them to do a deal with the Shah, because I said, if you don't reach an amicable settlement in which you agree to split the oil and that sort of thing with him, he will take them by force. Then one of them, I think it was Sharjah, did the deal and let him, Shah, have the island, the other one didn't, and the Shah took it by force. I've forgotten the details, but I wasn't there.
That's right. So, what I would like to do now that we have sort of more or less covered your own career in Iran as ambassador is more the details of it. You traveled a lot in Iran. What was, and I believe that once you went to the Alamut and wrote a book about it, you did something with James Morris. Or
I did a book, yes, with James Morris called, just called Iran.
Yes.
Or Persia, it's called Persia in England and Iran in America. But that was just a travel book, a photographs by Roger Wood, and I did the descriptions.
The captions, as we call them.
Yes, there were 200, 300.
But you did travel a lot in Iran. Could you tell us a bit about your travels and your impressions of the country, of the people?
Well, both my wife and I greatly liked traveling. We loved Iran, we loved its people too, and by the time we had been there a couple of years, we talked reasonable Persian and were able to get around without an interpreter. We didn't like formality, so the Iranian government knew me well enough to know that I didn't want to have great estekbals when I went to places, and we used to travel simply in a Land Rover, take a tent. And very often we also went with a friend of ours, an Iranian, who was really, an Armenian from Georgia, originally come as a young boy from the, called Tampasian, still in Iran today, but he loved Iran and was a great horseman, and he would arrange mules or horses, and we would go off a week at a time, and sleeping on the floor of cottages and things like that, and had enormous enjoyment out of this and got to know parts of Iran not normally seen by a European. We did one marvelous one in Dodangay up in the northeast of the country. Then twice we rode across the mountains to the Caspian Sea in fairly rough conditions. And we I think I went to every town of importance in Iran, and then my wife and I, on another occasion, we, with the governor of Kurdistan, we rode across Nuristan from one end to the other, spent 3 days riding across it. So we did do a lot, and we developed an enormous affection for the country and the people, and were very sorry when we left, and very unhappy to know what's happened subsequently.
Because
but,
the people, our friend Tony Parsons said that one of the changes that came over Iran, the Iranians in the last 20 years, was that the people changed. They lost their sense of humor. They became surly. That's his word. I recall as my childhood, this is before those times, people having a terrific sense of humor. And so what did you feel a change?
No, I felt there was a change of mood in Tehran. There was too much interest in money and so on. But I would say this about Tony Parsons' criticism. I mean, I remember they were staying with him, and of course he'd been served mostly in Arab countries, and they had a different approach. And I remember taking Sheila Parsons out shopping one day in the Ferdowsi, and she came back and having expressed great surprise to find the Iranians so nice, you see, all these shopkeepers and so on. And I got the impression that that she, at any rate, had built up a wall against the Iranians without really getting to know them. I mean, she didn't talk any Persian. So I think that she, at any rate, tended to misjudge them. But of course, the shops we went into were mostly Iranian Jews in the Ferdowsi. But I mean, I remember coming back and being, told how nice they are, you see. So but against that, I would say that the Iranians in the businessmen, the ministers, and all that had were inflated with their own success in the world. I mean, the Iran's position in the world, and had become really rather intolerable. I remember Hubeida, the prime minister, gave a lunch for me my last visit, April 77. And I came away very depressed from this lunch, because he was somehow, there was something about him, his arrogance, which he didn't have in the old days. If he was a changed Hubeida, I thought, you see, everything was right as far as he was concerned, nothing wrong with the country. And that was April 77. And rather, we poor Europeans, we're doing much better than you. You know, there was that sort of feeling.
What were your, I mean, all the while that you were there, Hubeida was prime minister.
Mm.
What were your dealings with him, your impressions of him, any stories, anecdotes, confrontations, dealings that you had with him?
No, I don't think so. I always enjoyed dealing with him, but I don't think he really had any admiration for the British, and he was basically xenophobic, I think he was. And of course there was a big change in the whole attitude of the Persian government, which a change in some ways the better, because when I first went there, when the Minister of Foreign Affairs was Abbas Aram, and he would be rather scared of talking direct to the Shah. He was a man of very humble origin himself, and would summon me or the American ambassador to get our views, and would then go to the Shah and say, this is what the British ambassador thinks. Really getting across his own views, if it's turned, but in order to shield himself. And likewise, Ali Mansour, when he was prime minister, he was all too anxious to curry favour with me and the American ambassador, which summoned me up to his office. He was living up that summer in Shimran somewhere, and his office had an office, and want to know what the British thought about this, or were just trying to get an announcement in the paper, the British ambassador saw him. He was, to me, it was a sign of his uncertainty and insecurity. Aram, for instance, foreign minister, used to encourage me to say, you must see the Shah every month and talk to him. I said, no, I don't want to see the Shah every month. I would only see him when I had business. But for the use of the British and the Americans, but British because, as you know, the Iranians have a great belief in our invisible powers, which right up until Zahedi became foreign minister and Hodeida became prime minister existed. After that, the Iranians were much more nationalistic and did not want to get the British ambassador's views or the Americans to the same extent. That's in some ways a very good sign. It shows they've grown up a bit, you see. But nevertheless, it was a change of atmosphere very much as far as I was concerned, and I think the American ambassador too. But my dealings with Hodeida were always correct. I never fell out with him at all. And one felt that he was, in many ways, a good prime minister because he was acting at the Shah's orders at a time when the Shah was successful. I mean, I don't think he ever stood up to the Shah. I think he was just a yes man to the Shah. But nevertheless, he was a good administrator, and he didn't, as Amini had done, go and make long speeches to the press and that sort of thing. He kept a low profile. So on the whole, I had a fairly healthy respect for Hodeida as a prime minister.
And what about Asadullah Alam? You said that he was very useful.
Well, Asadullah Alam was a personal friend of mine. I'd known him before when I was there, and he was minister of the court most of the time I was there, or prime minister. He was very close to the Shah, closer than anybody else. And from my point of view, I was very lucky. The Shah, as soon as I got there in 1963, he told me, I remember, the first time we had a little, that was, what was it, the Ballet Rombert had come on to Tehran, and I was sitting immediately behind the Shah at the performance. I'd only been in Tehran a couple of weeks, and he said, I want you to see my Prime Minister regularly. This was, of course, Alam, and so it was arranged that I would ride with Alam every Friday at Farabad on the Shah's horses, which I did. He didn't always come, but usually he was there, and it was week after week we wouldn't talk any shop at all, but occasionally I could talk to him about problems, and he was invaluable to me as a direct line to the Shah, which meant that neither the Foreign Minister nor the Prime Minister could go and tell things to the Shah which would be misinterpreted. I could always get straight to the Shah, and this was invaluable to me. And so I regard Alam, from my point of view, as a great asset. He was, I think, in some ways a weak character, particularly as far as women were concerned, but he never, to my mind, to me, in my experience, ever showed any desire to profit by his friendship or the business which went to British firms, ever. In fact, I don't think I used to talk to him about oil and that sort of thing, but he never hinted to me that he would want his 10% rake off or something, because there have been so many stories about him acquiring great wealth, and his daughters live in great splendor in London, I know. But as far as I'm concerned, his hands were absolutely clean.
It never went through you anyway. It never went through you
anyway. Never, no hint of it either.
Yes. Any other personalities you want to talk about? Who struck you, or any other anecdotes that were symptomatic of what was going on? And
I think so. Well, an example of the Shah's suspicion of the British, I mean, might quote, you may remember in 1964, there was Ali Mansour as Prime Minister, and there was a bill went to the Majlis to give immunities to American forces, and it's a time when Ayatollah Khomeini made a name for himself. The Shah had told the American ambassador that there'd be no trouble, this would go through the Majlis at the same time as a bill on the Vienna Convention about diplomatic immunities. Well, instead of it going through without trouble, there were some 70 odd deputies either voted against it or abstained. And the Shah was furious over this because it was contrary to what he told the American ambassador, and he was not used to the Majlis taking an independent line. The Americans are very unpopular at the time, and I think a lot of deputies thought this would please the Shah. that at first he blamed Ali Mansour very much for this, the first day or so. And then, two or three days afterwards, I was telephoned by both Alam and by Aram, the foreign minister, asked to go and see him urgently. Alam was about to go off to Philadelphia. He was chancellor of the University of Shiraz, had a link with the University of Philadelphia, and was off to America that day. And he said, I want to see you before I go, urgently. Aram gave me the same message, but he said, I'm in bed with influenza, come and see me in my house. So I went to see Alam, and he said, look, somebody has convinced the Shah that you, the British, are behind this hostile vote in the House of, in the Majlis. And he said, the Shah has told me to come back via London to see whether this was you, Dennis Wright, or whether it's the British government's policy. And he said, somebody's convinced him all these deputies are friends of the British. So he said, you must act quickly. Then I went to see Aram. He told me more or less the same thing, and said, you must act very quickly. And he said, you must see the Shah and clear this up. Well, I said, I'll see the Shah tomorrow night, because his son, his brother is marrying Dr. Ekbal's daughter, and there's a big party at the officers' club, and I'm bound to talk to the Shah. He always talks to me at these occasions. It was invariable. Well, I went to the party, and the Shah ignored me entirely. I went back to Aram, who was in bed still, and said, look, the Shah wouldn't take any notice of me at all. He said, well, that's deliberate. He said, he sat with Ali Mansour, as you ought to. This is to show his confidence in Ali Mansour. But he said, you must act quickly. He didn't tell me that he said my counselor was to be expelled. This was Horace Phillip. He didn't tell me this. I had to come there later. So I phoned up Hudson Ahai, who was then Minister of Court, and said, I wish to have an immediate audience with the Shah.
What was his name?
Hudson Ahai. Q-O-D-S, Hudson Ahai.
Nahai.
And so I went to see the Shah that same evening, and after the exchange of pleasantries, I said, I understand Your Majesty thinks I'm trying to upset your government and have inspired this trouble in the Majlis. Why should I be doing this? And looked him straight in the eyes. And he flinched and he said, I accept your word. But there was a major confrontation with him, really. And I said to him also at the same time, I said, look, when Ali Mansour became Prime Minister, I went to him and told him that Alam was a friend of mine, and I rode with him every Friday, and I would continue to do so, but he wasn't to think I was against him. I said, what more could I do? Then anyway, the Shah dropped it, he wouldn't talk about it, and so that was that. But that gave you a measure of his suspicion. Another occasion, there was a man, Bakhtiar, Taimur Bakhtiar, head of Sabah, was in exile, and he knew our consul in Nice. Our consul's name was, I forgot his name now, but anyway, was on his last job, retirement in Nice, and Bakhtiar went to call on him. And the consul very properly, without any warning, and the consul took him out to lunch. The consul reported this to me and to London, and I said that we must tell the Shah immediately, because he's so suspicious of Bakhtiar and the British that he will think we are intriguing. So we told the Shah that Bakhtiar got in touch with our consul and gave him lunch. About a year later, when the Shah was having trouble with Iraq and the Kurds and so on, he was backing the Kurds, you know, but there had been an entente of them. And Bakhtiar was by this time, I think, in Baghdad or somewhere, but Alam got hold of me on instructions and said, the Shah is very angry with the British. He has information that you are intriguing with the Prince of Bakhtiar through British consulates in Europe. And he's absolutely furious about this. So I telegraphed London and said, would they check up on all Bakhtiar's known friends? I mean, the only ones they knew were this consul in the East. Nancy Lambton was a friend of his, and there may be one or two other people. Well, we checked up, and nobody had seen him except the man in Nice, and only that one occasion. So I went back to the Shah and said, on such and such a day, I told you about the meeting in Nice between the British consul and Bakhtiar. Have you any other evidence? He said, no. That was that. It's a case when his memory went wrong, you see. But that was the sort of thing we were up against all the time, and one of the reasons why one couldn't afford to have dealings with the opposition, because after all, an ambassador has got to do business with the ruler of the day.
Now, when I interviewed Tony Parsons, Peter Ramsbottom, and various other people, they said this, that they had absolutely not an inkling of what was up, especially with the mullahs and so forth, and that it is a myth that the British have had any dealing with the mullahs, or the opposition, or they knew what they had. So in other words, the official version
that
of the events,
true.
That the official version of the thing, the way Tony has written in his book, and so forth, are absolutely correct. Well, just by chance, I had drinks at a party the other evening with Lord Erskine.
Erskine.
Well, he's a lord, but he's a businessman.
Yeah.
A wealthy man who had a lot of dealings with business and a lot of dealings with Persia.
Yeah.
Great lover of Persia, went there 3-4 times a year apparently, in connection with his visit towards the end.
Yeah.
Now, what he said, and this has intrigued me,
yeah.
is that as early as 1975, the British ambassador had told him things are very bad, or the British embassy, I don't know whether it was the ambassador or somebody else, but anyway, the things are very bad, and there is trouble brewing, and could he get out his business as quickly as possible, and how quickly could he get out?
Yeah.
And he had said, well, in a few months or something, they had said, oh, no, do it as quickly as you can, because we have very good intelligence that really big trouble is brewing and that this regime won't last. So if they knew in 1975, how is it that Tony Parsons says he didn't know and there was no intelligence as late as 77, 78?
I don't believe Lord Erskine, that's all, because I'm pretty certain that that was the whole, I went to Vietnam in 75, who was ambassador, maybe Ramsbottom, but there was no indication of that, either from the MI6 people or the thing, and I just, either he was talking to some Iranian and put it in, you know, because Iranians were apt to build up, so, but I just do not believe it, because if that had been so, the embassy would have reported. And if what Tony says in his book, which I believe is absolutely true, because he had access to all his own papers, because since having worked for Maggie Thatcher, he was able to refresh his memory, he makes it quite clear that he, though he saw there was instability in Lisbon, that on balance the Shah had the position in control, and he was recommending to British firms right up to the end that they should come and work there. Rightly or wrongly, he was that was his life. But I don't believe for one minute that anybody in the embassy said that in 75.
How would a man like that invent such a thing and pull out his business?
Well, somebody may have got at him, but not at the embassy, because the embassy was convinced, I think, certainly in 75, and right up, I tell you the story about by seeing Akbar in 77. When he told me how much corruption, etc., there was, but even then the embassy were not reporting that things were going on. And I saw when I was in Russia, 2 weeks ago, I had lunch at our embassy with Vinogradov, who was the Russian ambassador at the time of the revolution.
Did you?
Yeah.
What happened?
And he was very interesting. I didn't know him, but our ambassador got him round to lunch. You know, it's very difficult to get Russians to lunch, but he used me as a bait, you see, and this chap. And he told me that they had no idea what was going to go on. And he said that none of us have. I said that the Israelis had some intelligence about it, but in the last few months, but nobody else had, and I just do not believe Erskine, or if it was, it was not done on a chip for the British Embassy.
What did Vinogradov say about, you obviously talked with Vinogradov about the events in Iran and so forth.
Yes.
What was his view of the situation?
Well, I mean, insofar as we told that the situation was more what's going to happen in the future. He thought it was the Ayatollahs were going to continue reigning. He didn't think there'd be any big change.
After Khomeini?
Yes. And that's the general view we have in England, too.
But it'll go on. Why is that? Because there's no alternative?
Well, because there's no opposition. This Iranian lawyer I talked gave me the caviar 2 days ago, who goes back to Tehran 2 or 3 times a week. He's based in Paris. But he told me just the same thing. He said there's no real opposition in Iran at all. The opposition here doesn't count in Bakhtiar and people like that. I mean, they haven't got a ghost of a chance, in my opinion. They just...
What about the army? Somebody out of the army?
Well, yes, if somebody emerges in the army, you see, that's what one would like to see. Raise a hand, but not with a British label on it. With an Iranian label. I mean, the last thing that can happen is for anybody to emerge who got an Iranian, an American or a British label on it, is kiss of death. And that's why I think all these people in Paris are just barking up the wrong tree. You know? Somebody has got to emerge in Iran. It'll happen eventually, but not. No, that's very interesting about Erskine, but I've never heard of him. One thing, Lord Erskine, and what's he called?
Of something or other.
When has he been?
Tell us about this famous pub.
Well, it's not famous. It's a pub which, as far as I can discover, was named after the visit of the Shah in 1873, in Australian Shah. And nobody's ever heard of it or thought of it until some enterprising member of the Iranian embassy in the 1960s saw it and then complained to the Foreign Office. This was when Mr. Aram was Foreign Minister. Went to the Foreign Office and said, this is very insulting to call a pub. And the Foreign Office tried to explain that to have a pub called after you was very rather, we had lots of pubs called after our kings and queens. It was not an insult, but rather a compliment. So nothing happened.
Yes. Have you ever been there?
No. Well, I've been in touch with the owners of it.
What about other members of the royal family? Did you have any dealings with Princess Ashraf, Prince Shams, the brothers? Or?
Princess Ashraf at arm's length. I had no use for her at all.
Why is that?
Because she had such a reputation for corruption and immorality that I didn't want to be associated with her in any way. And I think, and I never asked at the embassy the whole time I was there. And I had to go once to a party at her house, but I never went again. And so that was my view of Ashraf. Others, Ghulam Reza, he was a rather lazy non-entity, but perfectly amiable, and I raised him to a trip to England. He stayed at Balmoral, I think, with the Queen. And the one I saw most of, but again only once or twice a year, was Prince Abdulrahman and his wife, because they were in disgrace with the court, and they used to entertain down at their place on the Caspian.
Why were they in disgrace?
Because the story is, I never got the bottom of it, but I think the story is that Parisima, Princess Parisima, was alleged to have warned the Shah against, the Italian princess the Shah wanted to marry in the 1959 period, January, when I was in Tehran, everybody was waiting for the Italian princess to turn up, and she never did. And this was said to be because she was warned off by Parisima to tell what a bad lot the court were. That may or may not be true. Parisima denies it, but I've talked to her about it. But at any rate, you may remember she was never invited to the coronation even of the Shah, all the other princesses were, and was never invited to the palace. And they Prince Abdulrahman and Parisima used to have a farm up on the Caspian near Rash, and then they had a place on the beach, a huts, beach huts, and they arranged weekend parties there, and I used to get invited once a year with my wife, and we'd go down by special train or carriage on the train, and they would have our, usually there might be one other ambassador, the American or the French ambassador, and then a lot of mutual friends, usually farmer farmians, and we used to play charades and games, and it was a very friendly two or three days of relaxation. And I would invite them to dinner with us once or twice a year. But apart from that, I kept the royal family at arm's length, because I did not wish to be identified with the royal family particularly. I mean, not just because it was the Pahlavi family, but when I was in Ethiopia's ambassador, I took the same feeling. I did not want to be regarded as being in the pockets of the ruling family. And given the controversy about, well, the Shah and about Ashraf and so on, I kept them all at arm's length.
Mm. What did you think of Prince Abdulrahman?
Well, he was intelligent. He was the most intelligent. He was ambitious, because before the Shahs had a son, he saw himself as possibly being the heir presumptive of the 19. But he never asked any favours of me. I mean, he was. But I believe after, when money started coming in a big way, that all the royal family got involved in business deals. But at that time, he was interested primarily in big game hunting and in and running this estate up on the Caspian. But I was never close to any of them, really.
And what about the whole Farmoyan family? Because they were considered as the second family of Persia, being so numerous.
Well, I liked them. They were very intelligent, very amusing.
Which ones did you know?
Well, I knew Aziz, I knew Manucher, I knew Safiye Hanum, I knew she was married to Firuz, I knew Skender Firuz, Cyrus I knew, Ali I knew, I mean I Hafez, who's now in University of Texas, I knew, and I knew Mary Rice, you see, I knew them all pretty well, and or not all, because there were 34 of them, but I knew a number of them, and I liked them, but again, I was careful to keep them some distance, because as ambassador, it always struck me that one should not be identified with any clique or group of people, and particularly, you might say, the upper crust of society. I tried to spread my contacts as widely as possible, and one would, you know.
You were telling me about that famous party of that you gave, the stag party for the Shah on the 2nd of February 1967.
Yes, well, the Duke of Edinburgh was coming out on his way to Australia, I think, and the Shah had invited him to stop in Tehran and do some shooting. And so the Duke of Edinburgh said he would like to give a party at the embassy for the Shah, and I went to the protocol people at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and said that he told me that the Shah would never go to any foreign embassy unless it's a state visit. So then I was, one of my morning rides with Mr. Alam, I told him that who was arranging the shooting up in the Caspian for the Duke. I said that they were told Duke couldn't ask the Shah at the embassy. And he said, nonsense, I think he'll come to your embassy. And I'll write to him, he was in Switzerland I think at the time. And a few days later I got a message, yes, the Shah would be very happy to come to the British Embassy to dine. So I then arranged a party of which there would be six people on the Iranian side and six on the British side. As the Duke was without the Queen, they decided to make it a stag party. And it was a very successful party because the Shah stayed late, and the Duke is a good conversationalist, and there was a lot of ragging and talking and things. It was a very good party, and I thought there would be a lot of problems over security, and I didn't tell the servants until the day before, or told the cook when the Shah was coming, But I asked about security, whether I should provide food for a lot of the members. Told no, there'll just be the Shah's two or three ADCs who'll be with him. And so I arranged for them to have dinner in the next room. We had a small dining room, and to have a room with my wife's secretary, who was living with us, a girl, and the Scotland Yard sergeant, who was in charge looking after the Duke of Edinburgh. And to my consternation, and the administrative officer of the embassy. And the three Iranians were top-level soldiers, generals and admirals. Anyway, they had the leftovers from our dinner. But it was a very successful evening. There was no publicity. And for two or three years, I mean, I kept quiet about it and didn't tell people. But it was a unique occasion, because the Shah, I've never heard of him going to a foreign embassy except for a state visit, and he did do me the honour, if you like, of coming to our embassy and having this dinner.
And did you go shooting with the party?
I don't shoot, but I didn't. The Duke flew up there and went shooting himself.
And who accompanied you?
Mr. Alam, I think, went up with him.
That's all?
I think so, yes.
Any other salient events of that kind that happened during your tenure of office?
Well, there are others. I can't remember them now. I'm gradually sort of trying to mass them together to make my own
memoirs.
And I've done four chapters, but I'm doing the 1953 period first, you see. One had one's bad moments, but on the whole, I was extremely happy in Iran. I enjoyed it, and of course, one reason why I enjoyed it, because as I said earlier, the Iranians believe almost anything about the British. And going back for ancient history, really, 19th century history, about which I've written two books. And they gave me a position of people thinking I was far more important than I was. Whereas I was representing a second-class country, and they thought I had as much power as the Americans or the Russians, and of course I hadn't. But it made my position a very interesting one, because I was always being consulted or blamed for what went wrong. More often than not, it was blame, but it was great fun.
And why did you, how come that you stayed two terms instead of one?
Well, there were various moves which I heard of later to move me. One, there was a person that some talk about going to Moscow as ambassador, and the Foreign Office officials took the line I hadn't been in Iran long enough and was to stay there, and so I didn't go to Moscow. I was never then. Another occasion, I think, I'm not certain, after my full term, there was a possibility of my going to India, but at the last minute Harold Wilson, who was Prime Minister, amalgamated the Foreign Office with the Commonwealth Relations Office, and a job had to be found for the head of the Commonwealth Relations Office. And he was far better qualified than I was to India, because he'd served there before, he'd served in Pakistan. So he went, but I was never offered the job, but I believe I was meant to go there. And the third one was just a few years before I was due to retire, I was offered the job, or told that if I wished to go as, not ambassador, yes, ambassador of the Organization for European Economic Cooperation in Paris, OECD, this would be very acceptable to all the other ministers in Whitehall, because this was a Treasury Board of Trade. But the Foreign Office said, if you prefer to stay in Tehran, we are happy to leave you there. So I said, leave me in Tehran, because I didn't want to go to Paris. And so I escaped and stayed 8 years in Tehran, which for me was very enjoyable. I mean, very happy times.
But when after the Mossadegh, Roger Stevens became, you were chargé d'affaires, you left, and Roger Stevens became ambassador. Unfortunately, he's dead, as you know, and we can't talk to him. What did he tell you about his sojourn there at the time? You know, at the beginning that the Shah's sort of consolidating his position and trying to modernize and that kind of thing.
Well, Roger Stevens wasn't there, you see, at that time. Roger Stevens was there. He left in about 1958 or something. The Shah hadn't really started there. I mean, the Shah didn't really take off until 1963. And it was Geoffrey Harrison who, in his Barbara Stevens's view of the Shah was as critical as mine at the time, and he had very little use for him, thought he was a weak man, and was not, and he had no use for the royal family at all. And I would have probably agreed with that view at that time. And when Geoffrey Harrison left Tehran, he talked about the beginnings of this reform and so on, and he saw changes coming. But they didn't really start coming until the end of 1963. I'll pick out something like
that. In other words, all the while that you were here, really.
All the while I was there. That's it. Yeah.
So you really witnessed all the changes and so forth.
All of
them. All the changes.
That was why I was there, yes.
Yes. No. But were there any resistances to the moves, to the changes? I mean, you talked about the Muharram.
Yes, and then it was quiet.
After that?
If not until 1969, you've got this urban guerrilla movement coming. You know, there's a little bit of that about 1969 or 1970. And the first real serious indication of anything was when a group raided a police station up at Siakal on the Caspian, you may remember, in December or January 1970-71, maybe a bit later, because I was planning as my last trip in Iran before I retired of riding to the Caspian Sea from Qazvin with my wife in April. Instead of us having lots of parties in Tehran, we decided to spend the last weekend or weekend riding across the Caspian.
And this on horseback.
On horseback. And it was right there. And so we arranged this through a wife of a translator. She was a translator in the embassy. Her husband was a local Khan up at Siakal and on the Caspian. And April, unfortunately, it was very wet and cold. And all my other trips on horseback, I'd never been accompanied by the police or anything. I'd always gone by myself or with Iona and my wife. This time, because of this trouble at Siakal, where they'd shot up and killed, I mean, it's a famous incident in this urban guerrilla movement. They gave me, I think, 4 gendarmes to accompany us. And so they were very cold, because the first night we rode through snow and mud, and my wife was frozen, had to be lifted off her mule, you see. And then we got up into the Caspian, to the hills, and of course, by the time we got to Caspian, it was spring. But it was the last trip we did. And that was when it was the only time we ever had an escort, all of my 8 years. You see, so all the time I was there, it was calm. And after the Muharram riots, I just read you my last, I haven't got the whole dispatch, I'm not allowed to keep them, but I kept up. I think I've got it here. What I said in my last.
Your last dispatch to the Foreign Office?
Foreign Office, yes. Marie Gabrielle of Savoy. Did you not know that?
We are going back to what you were mentioning before.
Yes.
The Italian princess, the Shah one.
Yes, 59, yeah. It was all arranged, the bedroom was prepared and everything.
And she was called Marie?
Marie Gabrielle.
The Savoy.
Yeah. And then he put out feelers to Princess Alexandra, too.
And Princess Alexandra said no?
Well, we never got that far. She would never be asked. They would never allow it.
Why not?
Well, because one is a Muslim and the other is a Christian, and you know, that difference in ages. But did you ever know that? No, that was never done before my time. But I know it was Alam told me that he'd asked Geoffrey Harrison to.
The Shah had asked Geoffrey Harrison?
Yeah, well, Alam had asked Geoffrey Harrison on behalf of the Shah. No, I can't find this thing on the record.
This is your last dispatch?
Yes, it's just the quoting just a sentence about the discontent. My last dispatch of all, the one I wrote on my 60th birthday, 23rd of March, I said the White Revolution, having solved the immediate problem of Iran's post-war society, has stimulated the expectations of the rising generation in a way which could bring a fundamental challenge to all the autocratic concepts on which even the White Revolution was founded. This challenge will almost certainly come in the Shah's lifetime, and possibly in the next few years. That was...
69, was it?
That was in 71.
71, before you left.
That was 23rd of March. Then on the 20th of April, 19th, my last, literally my last. However, I'd said the Shah had done quite a lot of good in development. I said, however, despite the progress and prosperity of recent years, much criticism goes on. Student unrest has increased and imposes a new problem as well as a warning that the future would be far less plain sailing. So, you know, I was quick. And then when I first went to Iran in June 63, I was very skeptical about the Shah then. I do not believe for one moment that the weakness of character and judgment that he, the Shah, has shown in the past has been exorcised, though he now gives the impression of maturity and better understanding of international problems. The country is waiting for leadership, which somehow, despite all the brave words, the Shah never quite provides. So long as the army and security forces remain loyal, and without them the Shah is doomed, and allow no alternative leader, no Mossadegh, to emerge, the country will probably tag along for some time behind the only leader they have. But unless some progress is made to satisfy the material hopes raised by the reform program, there will eventually be trouble. That was in 1963.
Prophetic.
Yeah, so I wasn't so far wrong, you see, although I never put my finger on the mullah, so I thought he...
You thought the trouble would come from the...
These intellectuals and the students and the liberals. But I don't think in 71 the mullahs were that much of a menace. I think it was only when you have these huge movements from the countryside into the towns and the captive audiences and the mosques, the lack of food, the lack of work, the lack of housing, the importation of thousands of foreigners to build jobs, and inflation. I mean, all these things, you see, which happened long after I left. And that's, I think, when things started to go wrong. 71 was a turning point because, you know, the three things that happened then. One, he won his battle against the oil companies. In February and March, he got the price of oil up. You know, he was leading the OPEC countries. That went to his head. Secondly, there was the Persepolis Jamboree, kings and queens. Not our queen. I recommended she shouldn't come.
Why was that?
Because we'd had a lot of trouble with the Shah over Bahrain and things like that. You know, he'd been over the islands. There was a lot of hostile press of the oil. You know, generally the Shah has been highly unhelpful to the British, and I thought, why the hell should the Queen come and please him? And so I recommended she shouldn't come, and she didn't, I have to say. And the third thing was, of course, we pulled out of the Persian Gulf, and that left a vacuum, and the Americans quite rightly said the Iranians are the people who should hold the peace there, and we agreed with that. But what we didn't agree with, we never asked, was giving the Shah carte blanche to have all the arms he wanted. After that, he he went berserk. Did you see what I wrote about the Shah's obituary I did? Did you ever see that?
Where was it?
It was in the Spectator I did it. But you might like to read it, because that, I think, gives my impression of the... Yeah, there. You can read that.
You read it.
It's too long. It's too long to read, but you can get it. Make a note of it. It's Spectator, the 2nd of August, 1980.
But if there's anything you want to quote from that, go ahead.
No, it takes too long. Well, I talked about his successes in 71. I said, these successes turned an already vain man into a megalomaniac who would tolerate neither unpalatable advice nor criticism. Such was his sensitivity that he ordered a vicious press attack on Sir Roger Stevens, a former British ambassador to Iran, because of a book review he had written, which was published in the Spectator in February 1977. Shortly afterwards, when I visited Tehran for the last time, I remonstrated with the Shah for authorizing this attack. But I see he was criticizing BBC and everything. I said, well, why do you attack Roger Stevens, one of your best friends? Is he? And I quote, pointing out that Sir Roger Stevens was a well-known friend of Iran and his review could only be regarded as favorable to the Shah's achievements. The Shah curtly answered that Sir Roger had no right to refer to his reforms as moderate. They were radical. He would listen to no one. And that review, Parviz Raji telephoned me and said, had I read this review, he telephoned about something else, but it was to ask about Weidenfeld doing a book on the Shah, and I advised against it. I said it would only be sycophantic and it wouldn't do any good at all. Then he said, had I seen this review in the Spectator? He said, a very good review. So I looked at it, and that's it. And a very good review, it was it. Very favorable to the Shah. I mentioned Savak on passing, but nothing unpleasant. Roger was a very great friend.
Review of what? What was the review of?
Two books on Iran.
Oh, I see.
But somebody in the Iranian embassy, the Savak man, I suppose, telegraphed, you see, to Tehran and said, this monstrous man, Stevens, is calling your reforms moderate. So Shah says, right, attack him. So they have a vicious article in Tehran written by that Amir Tahiri, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
And what did the article say?
Well, I've forgotten, but it was attacking Roger Stevens. And when I saw the Shah, I said, why do you allow this sort of thing? I said, Roger is one of your best friends. I said, he's regarded in England as I am, as a friend of Iran's. And this article, I didn't dare let on that Parviz had said it was a good article, because that would have been the end of Parviz, you see.
So, what about the trips you took to the Allée à la Moute? You took several trips
there. Yes, I went there, I think, three or four times. And the only once, though, did I go right the way over the pass and down the other side to the Caspian. And that was, I've forgotten what year, but my wife had got shingles and couldn't come with me, but I went with my friend Tamp, I mentioned earlier, Tamp Asian, and we had great difficulty getting mules because we went to the end of the Land Rover route and then we camped for the night and tried to get mules the next day and we couldn't get them. There were two girls with us, my wife's secretary and Tamp's girlfriend, whom he's since married, a German girl. And so I had to walk really most of the way, and I had a chronic attack of diarrhea. I was very, very weak. I had to walk right up this pass to about 13,000 feet. And up the top, although we had tents with us, we had one mule carrying us, there was a couple of huts up there, peasant houses, and we slept on the floor there. And then went down the next day. Took 2 days to get to Caspian, through the most marvelous country, I mean, starting with shrubs and then getting trees and forests, but it was absolutely lovely. And so I have very happy memories of that one. And then I did one or two other trips in Talesh, you know, which is further near the Russian frontier, looking for trout and fishing for trout, but there are a few trout there. But my trips in Iran were ones I have very happy memories of. And usually my wife was with me, but not always. Sometimes I went with just Tamp and a couple of men on my own.
Were you aware during your 8 years in Iran, for instance, of Russian intrigue in Persia? I mean, there was the Tudor party, but the Tudor party was such a
threat. Yes, well, it had been, in a way, sort of silenced. No one was aware that the Russians were broadcasting from Azerbaijan or somewhere, and they were broadcasting also from the Bulgaria, I think, to Iran, hostile propaganda. But outwardly, of course, the Russians were on friendly terms. They were doing the pipeline from the south to Masjid-e-Suleiman to Astara,
They were building factories, and on the whole, the Russians were careful not to get into trouble in Iran. So I don't think there was any major intrigue at that time. The Russians, I think, I don't know, but I think were more concerned with keeping the Shah off his guard, really, and penetrating the country peacefully with factories and developing the copper mines or whatever it was, the coal mines in Yaz, the steel mill outside Isfahan and that sort of thing. And were careful not, although there were occasional scandals when somebody was expelled, I think, Russian. But on the whole, I was not aware of any great intrigue going on at the time.
What was their long-term plan, do you think? Or were they too busy with Afghanistan?
Well, I think the long-term plan would be to see as it is around the world, to see a communist government. But they had tried, you see, in 19... After the Shah broke off relations, negotiations with the Russians in 1959, I told you I was involved in that. There was very strong propaganda against the Shah from Moscow and attacking him, and but it didn't succeed. I mean, and therefore in 19, I think in 62, the Russians decided to make the best of a bad job and come to terms with the Shah, and they had some, I think the Shah gave an undertaking not to allow any foreign military establishments in the country, and there was an air agreement, and thereafter the Russians tried to work with the Russians, with the Iranians, and had these joint enterprises like the steel mill and things like that. So I think that the Russian aim was to go about it long term wise and a game of chess, not to rush at it.
Yes.
I think that's still their policy.
With the Khomeini regime?
Yes, same, same thing.
You don't think that they are trying to penetrate the Revolutionary Guards who are setting up as a separate, you know, rather like Hitler's SS.
Yes.
Apparently they are setting up their own army and their own...
I've absolutely no idea. I'm out of touch now, and I just don't know. I mean, it would be idle to speculate. I just don't know. But long-term wise, one knows the Russians want communist regimes everywhere, and if they can get them, they will, whichever way suits them. But I think at the moment they're a bit perplexed of which way to jump, because Khomeini takes an anti-Russian line, he's anti their policy in Afghanistan, and so they're keeping a low profile.
He doesn't do anything about it, does he? He doesn't help the Mujahideen.
No, but he's not. He did, he rounded up a lot of Russian spies, didn't he, and 2 or 3 years ago, and then expelled a lot of Russians. The Russians didn't react very strongly. So I think they're just playing carefully and low profile.
And what about the British? What do you think their outlook is now? What is going to happen?
Well, I'm not that closely in touch with affairs anymore, but my guess is, and the impression I get from talking to my friends who are more directly concerned, is that the present regime, even after Ayatollah, is going to continue. That the exiles abroad are not going to achieve anything at all, and that if there is to be a change in Iran, it's got to come from inside. Possibly some leader in the army like Reza Khan will arise, or somebody like that. A strong man who will be accepted as a man of the people, and who will get rid of this present oppressive regime. But, you know, it's idle to speculate, one can't tell.